This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Traveling by air has never been safer. For years, airlines have put practices and procedures in place that make flying a safe, if not entirely comfortable, experience. And a lot of people could learn a thing or two from their efforts.
I started specifically looking at different procedures, how we do it in aviation versus how we do it in clinical chemistry. And I ended up just making these mental notes and comparing them to each other.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a pilot who is also a doctor and clinical chemist about what the world of medicine could learn from the world of aviation. And since we're spending some time talking about flying, we'll spend the academic minute underground talking about caves. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Though you think they'd be different, flying an airplane and practicing medicine may be more related than you might think. The August 2016 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry highlights the similarities between aviation and laboratory medicine. In a feature article, Dr. Geisa Bedour, who is a medical doctor, a clinical chemist, and a pilot, offers his thoughts on what clinical chemists can learn from the field of aviation. Dr. Bedour is a professor of pathology at the University of Colorado in Denver and is the medical director of clinical chemistry and toxicology at the VA Eastern Colorado Healthcare System in Denver. He is also an instrument-rated pilot with over 2,200 flight hours. So, Dr. Bedour, you're a flying clinical chemist. How long have you been doing both?
For a long time. I've been flying for over 24 years, and I've been a clinical chemist for over 25, but I also have clinical medicine experience before I got into clinical chemistry.
And when did you first notice the similarities between flying and practicing clinical pathology? When did you realize that physicians could learn from aviation?
That was a slow process. During my years as a clinical chemist, I was interested in management and quality assurance and quality improvement. And then I noticed some issues in clinical medicine and clinical pathology that were not done properly. And eventually, probably when I most closely started paying attention to the similarities was after a trip that I was able to take to the Raytheon Beach Aircraft Factory in Wichita. This was in 2007. At that time, the factory was open to us pilots, and we could tour it, and I was able to see how the company was assembling military airplanes. They also were working on civilian airplanes, but what really impressed me was the military airplane production, where they were following very good Six Sigma rules and Six Sigma principles.
And let me interrupt here and point out that that term that Dr. Bedour is using, Six Sigma, is a method that provides organizations tools to improve the quality of their business processes. This increase in performance and decrease in process variation leads to defect reduction and improvement in profits, employee morale, and quality of products and services. Six Sigma quality is a term generally used to indicate a process is well controlled, and that's what Dr. Bedour is talking about here.
And I was very impressed by that because at that time, the hospital I had been working at the time was trying to introduce Six Sigma procedures, but they didn't really do well with that. They bogged down on unimportant things, and they did not really catch the essence of Six Sigma. So that visit opened up my eye, and I started looking into if aviation does Six Sigma so well, what else may Six Sigma be doing? And I started specifically looking at different procedures, how we do it in aviation versus how we do it in clinical chemistry. And I ended up just making these mental notes and comparing them to each other. Another factor that opened up my eye was also related to Six Sigma. And you know that Six Sigma procedure came from the Toyota factory. And it was very popular to use Six Sigma processes in the early 2000s, actually probably from the 1990s onwards. And then in 2009, Toyota had to recall 3 million vehicles because of the accelerator pedal issues. And then a few years later, I think in 2014, they recalled another 7 million vehicles because of the fire danger. And that was the other side of looking at the Six Sigma aviation and non-aviation related Six Sigma usages, how overdoing something and mechanically following a good principle can lead to disasters like it happened in the Toyota case. So that's how I started.
Medicine has been striving to improve outcomes and eliminate errors for decades. Do you feel that these efforts haven't been sufficient and we need to turn to the methods used by aviation and these other industries for ideas?
Yes, I do. Why I do this? Because if you look at what happened in aviation, back in the 1970s, fatal accidents rate was about 30 fatal accidents per year in commercial aviation. And by the mid-2000s, this was cut down into 5 fatal accidents a year. I'm only talking about commercial aviation. I'm not talking about general aviation and home builds and such, but commercial aviation. On the other hand, from another standpoint, the number of fatalities that were involved in these accidents decreased also. The more than 2,000 people who died in aviation-related accidents in the 1970s, this number is now less than 500 for all over the aviation field. And this happened while the total volume of flights, the size of the airplanes increased, and now we are at the point where about 4 accidents, fatal accidents, are happening per million flight hours in the airlines and a little bit more for the commuter and the charter airlines, 11 or 12 fatal accidents per million flight hours annually. So this is a huge improvement in 30, 40 years. On the other hand, many of us are aware of the 1999 report by the Institute of Medicine. It was entitled "To Air is Human," and that was the publication that turned the medical community toward the magnitude of errors and also to show that this error rate, what we have in medicine, is unacceptable. The Institute of Medicine in that paper reported or estimated 98,000 deaths per year that were attributed to medical errors. The current statistics estimate between 200 and 440,000 medical errors per year, not just fatal, but all types. And numerous organizations, the Institute of Medicine, American Hospital Association, they claim that the error events are as high as 21% for all errors and as high as 1.4% for lethal errors in medicine. This is very, very high, and this is unacceptable. So it's not just my assessment, but also the assessment of institutions and other professionals who look into this information. The reason for this, I think, is the complexity that we deal with, that we have to deal with in medicine, the culture that we still have in medicine, and the understanding of what needs to be done. This is the same for medicine, and it is the same for the airlines. So I think by observing somebody who is 30 years ahead of us, we can learn and maybe we can improve.
So since aviation has demonstrated these great improvements in error prevention, you are suggesting that we should copy their techniques and apply them to medical practice and maybe achieve the same improvement.
I am not advocating a mechanical copying. There is no direct copying the two. There are similarities between the two fields of aviation and medicine, but they are not exactly similar. What I'm advocating is to look at the principles and techniques that aviation uses and try to apply those to the medical field. For example, the environment is different. Commercial aviation is a very much industrial production, cookie-cutter operation. The airlines have the same airplanes, they have the same education, the experience, and they have big infrastructure supporting the flying operations. Medicine is different. Medicine is more individualized. So some things that aviation approached and aviation applied cannot be directly applied in medicine. My thinking is that if we discover the similarities, we can apply similar methods of solution, but where we recognize the differences between aviation and medicine, we can look at what aviation has done well or didn't do well, and we can use that and adjust and innovate for our purposes. In other words, what I'm thinking about is that we can not just learn from aviation, but we can also learn from the mistakes that aviation made even when they were trying to improve the error rate or improve their performance.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Geza Bedour continues with another topic medicine could learn from the airlines, crew resource management. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them all online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Geza Bedour, a professor of pathology at the University of Colorado Denver and the medical director of clinical chemistry and toxicology at the VA Eastern Colorado Healthcare System in Denver. He's also an instrument-rated pilot with over 2,200 flight hours, and we're talking about what medicine can learn from the field of aviation. Doctor, in your article, you mentioned crew resource management, CRM. And you stated that CRM has not been widely applied in medicine. Could you explain this in more detail?
Yes, this is a very important thing for me because I see the differences and I feel that we need to learn CRM or crew resource management in our practice in medicine. So to start with, you have to understand that all pilots who fly commercial airplanes have pilot licenses. They are fully licensed, and many of them have hundreds or even thousands of hours of flying time before they can get into the commercial aviation, before they can carry passengers. However, even with this background, they can have differences in experience. One can have 1,500 hours of flying time, and another one can have 40,000 hours of flying time. In spite of this, they keep alternating their roles. In commercial aviation, there is a crew of two pilots. One of them is the flying. The other one is the non-flying pilot. And between different segments of the flight, they alternate in what their roles are. The roles are well-defined, and they alternate these roles regardless of who is the more or less experienced. This way, they can learn from each other, and at the same time, they can also observe each other and correct each other. There is other aspects of CRM. For example, there is communication. If the two pilots are equal in their responsibilities, they can communicate and they can openly tell each other, oops, you did something wrong, or did you do this? Even if it was not wrong, they check on each other. This helps conflict resolution. And they have certain rules that they have to follow. For example, the sterile cockpit rule, that means that in certain phases of flight, they cannot do anything else but concentrate on flying. They can also, during CRM, they can also unlearn authoritative management styles, because very strong authoritative management stifles cooperative problem solving. Examples: when this CRM was not practiced properly, where there was no communication, for example, the Air France flight that had an accident some years ago over the Atlantic, because the pilots did not recognize that there was an problem with the flight management system. But even when one of them recognized it, they did not communicate properly, and the two pilots, the two flying pilots, were introducing contradictory input into the flight management system. Another example would be the Colgan Air, where the pilots were not following stereo cockpit rules, and they crashed the airplane in icing condition while they were musing about, oh, look, they literally were saying, oh, I've never seen this much icing before, instead of doing the evasive action and get out of this. In medicine, there is potential to have this kind of authoritative environment and or not to observe the sterile cockpit rule, because in medicine we can be distracted or we can give in to an other colleague in higher position or higher authority. But those situations can lead to similar errors that we had seen in aviation. This is why some elements of crew resource management have been introduced in medicine, especially in surgery, to prevent this kind of a problem. But it's not widely used across all fields, and it's not widely used in practice. As a matter of fact, in some cases, if a subordinate disagrees, expresses an opinion, even if the opinion is correct, but he disagrees with his or her boss, it is considered insubordination or criticizing the boss. And many times management will consider this to be disobedience on the part of the person who may have recognized this problem. So what we really need to do is unlearn these practices on both sides. The person who is in the lower position has to learn to be able to speak up openly and point out potential or existing problems. But management in higher position, they have to learn to listen and accept that. And aviation does this very well.
Well, finally, Doctor, you've expressed concern about the use of computerization and automation and that it could cause harm as it did in aviation. Do you think we should be scaling back or even stopping our heavy reliance on computers in medicine?
No. Computers are here to stay, and they should be here. They have very vital roles. They contribute to a lot of error prevention practices. They are very helpful. They can transfer information from the laboratory to the clinician, and from the clinician to the pharmacy, and from the pharmacy back to the lab, and other aspects. So I'm not advocating doing away with them. However, over-reliance on computers and instruments, it can lead to problems. One place I had worked, there was a blood gas machine outside of the laboratory, and that blood gas machine had not been serviced for years because it was in the possession of the clinical service that was using it. Nobody ever questioned that in the clinical department, because the instrument gave a digital readout that read as 98. And they were happy with that. That's a normal result. Nobody questioned it. Additional examples are a mechanical dependence on normal ranges. I get phone calls almost every day from clinicians who are calling because the normal TSH value, for example, that's the latest one I got, the normal TSH low end in our laboratory is 1.0, and the patient had a result of 0.99. And the clinician is now trying to find out what's wrong with the patient. This is over-reliance on computers and computer numbers. And there are others that I could list in this area. From an other standpoint, there is the complete reliance on medical records, laboratory computer downtime, hospital information downtime can prevent availability of these results or slow down the availability of them. We still have to teach our doctors that they need to think in context and they may have to be able to treat without an immediate availability of test results and laboratory results. So this is what I'm saying about the computers, that we need to be very selective of what we use and how we use them, and we also need to be able to keep ourselves focused on medicine even when the numbers from the computers are not available.
Dr. Gay Sabador is a professor of pathology at the University of Colorado and is the medical director of clinical chemistry and toxicology at the VA Eastern Colorado Healthcare System in Denver. You can read more about the aviation medicine theory in the August 2016 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Nobody can learn anything by sticking their head underground. Unless you want to learn about caves, then it kind of works. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
To explore our universe, head underground. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Robert Brinkman, professor in the Department of Geology, Environment, and Sustainability at Hofstra University, discusses what caves have to tell us about our planet and even Mars and beyond.
The visit of President Obama and the first family to Carlsbad Caverns National Park comes at a time of a major renaissance for cave research in the United States. Caves in the U.S. hold important clues to our own planet as well as our solar system. Take human exploration of Mars, for instance. When NASA researchers were trying to figure out how to keep astronauts safe on the red planet, they realized that Martian caves would be great sites for base camps and identified caves on Earth that closely replicated the conditions of those on Mars. We need to understand how to live in caves if we are to do so in space. Caves also provide opportunities for mitigating global climate change. Speleologists are studying how deep caves can be used for carbon sequestration, or how the carbon cycle can be modified to enhance carbonate rock formation. Plus, cave formations such as stalactites contain isotopic information about past climate conditions that date back much farther than ice cores and tree rings. Due to their geologic isolation and the extreme competition for resources, caves represent a vast potential for the discovery and identification of new drugs. Currently, 99.8% of all antibiotics we use come from microorganisms found in the environment. Cave biologists are actively on the search for new cures for diseases. The public's perception of cave science has matured in the last few decades. No longer are caves mysterious unknown landforms ripe for exploration. Today they are the subject of important scientific research that is changing the world. And as the president and his family discovered, sites of great natural beauty that have enchanted visitors for generations.
That was Robert Brinkman of Hofstra University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other national productions or WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.